This weekend starts right after this.
He's in the paint, down by two. Can he do it? The ball is up, and nothing but net! The crowd goes wild!
Hey, Greg, waiting on your PC again.
Yep, want a front row seat to the big game?
No, I'm good.
A workplace that doesn't work is anything but beautiful. Give your employees the power to do their best work and reduce downtime by 50% with new, powerfully performing Dell and Intel technology. Learn more at dell.com/business.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The wrong renovations for your home. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
Before you call a contractor or handyman, understand the pricey upgrades that could actually decrease your home's value.
Could your kids sit quietly for a meditation? Wall Street Journal writer Sue Schellenbarger examines the family meditation session.
In sports, the NFL teams with the best and worst backup quarterbacks.
And what you'll get when you call the Butterball Turkey Talk Line.
You know, we've been in existence now for over 35 years. And one thing that remains the same is tradition, bringing back, you know, a lot of the past memories and recipes and photos, if you will, and trying to bring them to the present.
Nicole Johnson is co-director of the Talk Line. She joins us from the call center. We tease her later in the hour. Well, as we've told you, French authorities believe a 27-year-old Belgian named Abdelhamid Abaoud masterminded the terror attacks that took place in Paris. He was confirmed dead following a raid by security forces this past week. But the focus on Mr. Abaoud helps emphasize how tiny Belgium has taken on an oversized role in the European theater of jihad. David Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic, says the country has provided a steady flow of fighters to ISIS in the Middle East and has been the site of planning of attacks in Europe. David, what's going on in Belgium?
There's a bunch of things going on. One, there's a decent-sized Muslim population. It's about 6% of the population, according to the most recent estimates we have. And a lot of people who are there are underemployed. They're poor. They're a little bit marginalized society, which makes it a good breeding ground for extremism. And then there are also some factors that make it particularly useful for people seeking a mount of violent attack. Gun laws were relatively lax in comparison to neighboring countries until recently, which makes it easier to get guns. One of the strange things about Belgium is because of the language gap between French and Flemish speakers. Some of the security forces are not especially efficient, and so it's easier to get under get through the sort of dragnet of law enforcement. So the result is you've had hundreds of fighters going from Belgium to Syria and Iraq, and you've had this list of attacks that have been either attempted or have successfully gone through in Europe.
Wow. All right, so have the problems here then in some of these neighborhoods, I guess specifically around, or one neighborhood around Brussels, has this been long simmering?
Yeah, it has. And it's a situation where I think a lot of the world is now becoming aware of it, but it is not something that's new to the authorities in Belgium. So, for example, in January, shortly after the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, Belgian authorities arrested people in Molenbeek, this neighborhood, for attempting an attack. There have been several other attacks that have been planned there. And there's a group called Sharia for Belgium, which has been a major sort of focal point for jihadists in Belgium, founded by a 33-year-old Belgian guy who's now in jail after being tried last year for membership in a terrorist group. And he's sort of been the major recruiter and the focus for a lot of these radicals, taking either children of people, you know, often it's children of immigrants who were raised in relatively low-key and religious environments and become more religious, or else converts, Belgian converts to Islam, who then become involved radical groups.
Mm. All right, so the Muslims who have settled in this neighborhood, then why would they pick Belgium in the first place if they're not native to the country? Was there something that initially attracted them?
I mean, that's actually a good question. I think a lot of it involves once you have a critical mass of people, folks come. You know, they have relatives, they have friends, they have they know people who are there. You know, in some cases, I think there is a real opportunity for social advancement, and people are going after that, or they don't know what they're in for, but they're, for whatever reason, they feel like they need to leave their home country for safety or for economic advancement, and they end up in Belgium.
Wow. We're speaking with David Graham from The Atlantic, where he's a staff writer, and his piece is called What's the Matter with Belgium? All right, so do we know now how this might be addressed, if at all, in Belgium?
We don't know exactly what it will take. I mean, initially, Belgian police have been conducting some fairly aggressive raids in Molenbeek and trying to root out what they know. That seems like the logical step to begin with. The question is what you do in the longer term. Because a lot of these things are more involved. They involve people who are marginalized from society. They involve very high youth unemployment in this neighborhood. And so you have these conditions for extremism that are going to be harder to root out, even if you can go in and arrest people who you know are suspects now.
Right. All right, so Belgium, I think, as you point out, has either the highest concentration of Muslims per capita in a country of 11 million people, or the most fighters kind of per capita who are leaving. What are those numbers?
Yeah, it's the most fighters per capita. There have been more Belgians per capita going to Iraq or Syria than in any other European country, which is really pretty remarkable. The numbers are a little bit in dispute. The government says it's around 350. There's a guy named Peter von Ostaien, who's a well-respected independent researcher. He thinks it's closer to 516 as of last month. Some of these people have gone to Syria and have been killed. Some of them have been turned away trying to go. Some of them have gone and come back. In the case of this guy, Abaoud, who's the suspected mastermind of the attacks, we know that he was in Syria earlier this year, and we know he is a Belgian. He's now, it's not clear where he is. It wasn't clear where he was even before the attacks. Authorities thought he'd returned, but they had been unable to find him. So you get people moving through a revolving door between Iraq and Syria and then Belgium.
Yeah. Think the world is taking notice here about what's happening in Belgium?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I see tons of stories around this topic in the media. People are spilling at Molenbeek and trying to figure out what's going on in the neighborhood. And you've got the Belgian government saying that they need to really focus as well. And then on top of all that, you get combined EU efforts to try to fight terrorism. So I think there's going to be a lot more focus on what can be done in Belgium in the coming days.
Thanks, David. David Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Teaching your children how to meditate. It appears to be a growing trend. Here's Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger, who says it can have a positive impact even in the classroom. Sue, explain.
Took a look at the fact that a growing number of parents are actually using meditation exercises in the home with their children, helping them learn to focus on their breathing, just sit quietly and concentrate maybe on a candle flame. This has been taught in schools for a while, but I think more parents also are trying meditation at home.
Wow. What schools are trying it? Here in the U.S., you mean?
They do it actually as mindfulness training. There's a program called Mind Up, and others that are being conducted in schools that just help students learn to be calm, focus on their breathing, take a brain break is one phrase that's used. And it's not meditation so much as it is just the practice of mindfulness, which is one of the results you get from meditating. It helps kids calm down and less aggression, better focus.
The nuns that I went to school with had a paddle hanging on the wall. That usually created general mindfulness for us if we thought about doing something else.
You got quiet real quick, I bet, didn't you, Gordon? I know.
All right, so what are some of the basics, like if you're going to do this at home? I know you mentioned there's a lot of books about doing this at home, too.
There definitely are. First of all, let your child see you meditating yourself. Point out to your child some of the benefits, and maybe you get a burst of road rage and your child's with you and you say, I really flew off the handle fast on that. I think I need to meditate more so I have more calmness and control over my emotions. Teachers recommend starting slow, maybe with bedtime exercises at concentrating on their breathing. There's one little book about imitating a frog, the way a frog sits so quietly and yet is intensely focused. And then move up to just brief sessions of sitting, focusing on breathing, just briefly. And it's okay if a kid moves around also, I learned from these teachers. They're going to look around, they're going to wiggle. They can still gain some of the benefits of meditation, even if they're not completely still physically.
Wow. My family we're a group of four goofballs. I'm not sure that we could pull this off. You think by following along in a book we could actually do this for a few minutes?
Well, there's a lot of goofballs out there, and the stories I heard from parents were, some were pretty funny about the child starting to wiggle or pulling her sweatshirt over her head.
Right.
I think you need a sense of humor, and sometimes parents start, say, with a walk in the woods, that just stop and look at a tree and help your child learn to notice what the senses are taking in, or play a game with your child to pretend there's a little spider dropping on a thread from the brain when the child is upset down to the tummy. Go down where the tummy is and see how calm it is there. Isn't it quiet? These kinds of exercises can help a child not only just focus on what they're doing, control their emotions, but also fall asleep at night.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. Her piece is called The Family Meditation Session. So how long do you think, I don't know, you need a particular session to be in order to feel better or to, you know, decompress?
Interesting question. A small child isn't going to be able to sit still or even concentrate for more than 10 to 30 seconds. So, you know, the best you can do there is, you know, a good, deep, relaxing breath. I found that there's a bell ringing exercise where you ring a very resonant gong and ask the child to raise his hand when she can't hear it anymore. And this actually teaches children to focus without their even realizing it.
Interesting.
Yeah. So there are exercises you can do and gradually work up to being able to be still. I think the benefits can be realized in as little as a minute, honestly, with practice.
Oh, wow.
Mostly 5 to 15 minutes were the sessions that parents of 6, 8, 10-year-olds were doing.
Anybody pointing to a kind of noticeable difference in, let's say, a kid in school, or, I don't know, grades or behavior, something like that?
Absolutely. The goal isn't to actually change behavior, but it happens often as a side effect. One Pennsylvania couple has been meditating with their 8-year-old daughter for several months, and they're finding that she's paying attention better in school. She's able to focus on her reading at home more. Her grades have come up, and they really see a difference. The child really loves sitting with their parents in the morning. They do a candle-gazing meditation, and they think that's kind of elevated her self-esteem as well.
So, Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Are you in the market for a new car? This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka is here with some information to consider from InsuranceQuotes.com, which has put together a list of the best and worst car insurance deals.
You may not think much about insurance rates when you're about to buy a car, but you probably should. Deals vary widely. Here to tell us about them is Laura Adams of InsuranceQuotes.com. Laura, how did InsuranceQuotes.com determine the best and worst insurance deals, first of all?
We looked at the most popular vehicles of 2014 and 2015 so far in the year, and looked at what it costs to insure each of those vehicles on an annual basis and compared that insurance cost to its MSRP or its retail selling price to come up with a cost ratio for insurance. And we found some really surprising results. Some of the vehicles that came up at the top of the list as being the most affordable are some that you really wouldn't expect.
What are some of those?
We found that the Ford Explorer happens to be the most affordable car when it comes to insurance. And, you know, this is really surprising. You may think, well, it's a big SUV. You know, it's something that is an expensive vehicle, relatively expensive. But what we found is that the vehicles at the top of the list, while they are mostly SUVs and trucks, they are more affordable for insurance for a few different reasons, mainly safety. Insurance companies find that safer vehicles do get fewer claims. So that means you're going to pay a lower rate for a large vehicle like the Ford Explorer. The GMC Sierra was number two on our list. Chevy Silverado, Chevy Equinox, and then the Dodge Ram 1500. Those are the top five most affordable vehicles. At the bottom of the list, we see sedans like the Ford Focus, Toyota Corolla, Honda Civic. These vehicles, while they're inexpensive and pretty compact, are relatively expensive to insure. And that's because they're not quite as safe, and also they do tend to show up on the list of the most stolen vehicles each year. Insurance companies who see a lot of theft claims coming from certain makes and models will price those makes and models higher than vehicles that are not stolen as frequently.
You also took a look at the kinds of people who drive those vehicles too, right?
We did. It's interesting when you think about driver personalities, you know, who's driving a Ford Explorer versus a Ford Focus. When we take a look at the least expensive vehicles, some of these that are priced under about $20,000, the typical driver is probably going to be a younger person, you know, someone who's just starting out in their career, probably doesn't have much driving history behind them. This is compared to vehicles like the Ford Explorer that are typically driven by older consumers. They may be families that are toting kids around, have a safer driving history, and are going to be driving a little bit differently in that vehicle than they would in let's say, a smaller car. So all of these things, safety, theft, and driver personalities play a really big role in what we have to pay for different types of cars.
Do drivers have to consider the type of car in terms of what it costs to replace a bumper on one versus another?
Absolutely. That comes into play, which is why, in general, very expensive cars are more, you know, expensive to insure. But what's really interesting in this study is that if you're willing to, you know, buy a cheaper car, if you're looking at a cheaper model, we don't want consumers to just assume that it is going to be cheaper to insure. There are certain vehicles that, you know, like what we found on our list, are going to be relatively expensive to insure and may cost just as much on an annual basis as a more expensive vehicle. But replacement parts do play a big role. The Toyota Prius is one of the vehicles notably on our list that is relatively expensive to insure, and that's because it's got state-of-the-art electronic parts. If those, let's say the battery on a hybrid vehicle is damaged, that's very expensive to repair or replace.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Laura Adams from InsuranceQuotes.com. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. None of us stops learning after we leave school. In fact, you're listening to this podcast because you love to learn on a daily basis. That's why you should check out The Great Courses. The Great Courses offers engaging video and audio lectures presented by top professors and experts in their fields. A wonderful opportunity to learn about the subjects that fascinate you from experts who are truly passionate about their topics. The Great Courses has a collection of lecture series on music's great masters, including Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, and Tchaikovsky, each taught by music historian Robert Greenberg. Each lecture series has 8 45-minute episodes and explores these well-known musicians and composers, providing fascinating insight into their personal lives and how that impacted the music they created. The Great Courses are available in DVDs, CDs, streaming, digital downloads, or with the Great Courses apps. For a limited time, The Great Courses has a special offer for This Morning listeners. Order any of these 4 Great Masters courses for just $9.95. This special price of $9.95 is only available for a limited time, so order today. Go to thegreatcourses.com/deal. That's thegreatcourses.com/deal. Good news and bad news out of a new health insurance report from Aon. The good news, healthcare costs for companies this year rose at the lowest rate in at least 20 years. The bad news, as workers, our individual share of costs continue to skyrocket. Here's USA Today reporter Jane O'Donnell. Jane, what have you found?
Basically, what anybody with a job has probably seen, and depending on what industry they're in and how competitive it is for the industry to recruit, they might have seen it more or less. But basically, your deductibles, our deductibles are going up as they are. They're not quite as bad, not nearly as bad, I guess, as the people that are buying individual plans on the exchanges. But our deductibles are going up, and what we have to pay out of pocket is going up, and it's only going to get worse. For a couple more years.
I know that was my follow-up, I guess. How long can we anticipate that this is going to happen?
Well, you know, the folks I was interviewing for this story, which was based on a new study coming out, they were saying, from Aon Hewitt, they were saying that, you know, some of the companies just wonder how much longer they can offer insurance. And, you know, you hear that, and you've been hearing that for quite a while, but it does seem a little more ominous now. You know, are more companies going to start sending us to exchanges and turning to private exchanges, which aren't quite as bad? But the plans on the Affordable Care Act exchanges are often not that affordable unless you are getting pretty good subsidies.
Yeah. So here's the average employee in the middle. What's that employee to do as we watch these benefits kind of whittle away?
What we all need to do and what they want us to do and why this is happening is to be very selective about when we utilize healthcare services, and to shop around. And we're just not used to doing that. So many of us. I've never been one of these people that brought my daughter to the ER for every little thing, but I know an awful lot of moms that were doing that. They're trying to get people to be more selective about how and when they do that, and how many tests they get, and shopping around for the best prices. There's been so many stories about, you know, the incredible price variability, and they want you to look at the different hospitals and doctors and see who's offering the best price.
We're speaking with Jane O'Donnell, health policy reporter at USA Today. Her piece is entitled, Companies Continue Chipping Away at Health Insurance Benefits. Is it worse, say, for small companies versus large? You know, is there a leverage issue in there or not necessarily?
Yeah, it is really hard sometimes for the small companies, the ones I've talked to over the years, because, you know, you have one person, you know, who, God forbid, gets cancer, and it can really affect what the insurance policy costs for everybody there. Most, as you know, I'm sure that most of the big companies like my own are self-insured, but you know, it's pretty tough for them too. I mean, it's why you're going to be seeing a lot more wellness programs and more aggressive measures to try to get us all to not smoke, just live more healthy.
Boy, the one stat that really jumped out in your piece, you said the average amount workers have to contribute toward their health care is up more than 134% over the past decade. And that's attributable to what, really?
Well, the rising health care costs and drug costs, and, you know, just it has kind of leveled off the healthcare costs, but it's still very high. And you've seen plenty of coverage, I'm sure, on the specialty drugs, or costs are way up. And you know, you just it is amazing, but you know, it really does become, you know, it's pretty tough to afford for most people, because we aren't getting the kinds of raises that help us keep up.
Thanks, Jane. That's USA Today reporter Jane O'Donnell. It is 21 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. Just something to chew on before you go after a home equity loan to tackle some renovations at the house. MarketWatch reporter Amy Hoke has a look at remodeling projects that can actually hurt your home's value. Amy, take us through this.
Home improvement should improve the value of your home, but there are certain things that you might think will enhance the value of your home, but they actually detract from it. One of the improvements that we focused on a little bit in this article was making a larger bedroom by removing another one. So maybe you're dreaming of having, you know, kind of a luxury bedroom suite, like maybe one that you'd see in a hotel room, something that where you can have a sitting area and maybe a desk, a place to watch TV, and that might be appealing to you. But when you knock down the number of bedrooms that you have in the home, that will definitely impact you when you come to sell. And that's especially true if you have maybe a three-bedroom home and you're going to go to a two-bedroom home, or a four-bedroom home and you're going to go to a three-bedroom home, because typically the more bedrooms a home has, the more it will sell for. You know, if you have a lot of bedrooms, if you're talking about five or six bedrooms and you're planning on combining two, maybe that has a little bit less of an impact. Or if the bedrooms that you do have are very, very small bedrooms, and you have a lot of bedrooms, then maybe it makes sense to combine. But generally, you're going to be very careful before making that move if you're worried at all about the resale value of the home.
And it looks like closets are just as important as bedrooms.
Well, people like closets. They like to have a lot of closet space. They love walk-in closets. They go through a home and they'll count the number of closets that they're going to be able to pick up when they move into this home. So anytime you're making a move to take a closet out of a space, for example, one of the realtors I spoke with for this article said that a client took a closet out of the master bedroom to make a very large master bath, which they loved. But for resale value, it was a bad move, because it made the home much harder to sell.
We're speaking with MarketWatch reporter Amy Hoke. Her piece is called Renovations That Decrease a Home's Value. And if you wanted to turn your garage into another living space, that's also a no-no?
Yeah. I mean, again, people like their cars. They like to have a roof over their cars. Or if not, if that doesn't appeal to them, they certainly like the storage that a garage provides. So now, by refinishing that garage and making it a livable space, you know, you do increase the amount of space that you have to live in, but you're giving up that crucial storage space that a lot of people really want. One of the tips from a realtor I spoke with said that she said if you're going to do that, if you're going to make it livable space, leave the garage door on and just do it. I mean, I don't know if that's something that appeals to people or if that would bother them, but that is one way to get around it, so that you kind of leave the garage intact. So if the next buyer comes in and they want a place to put their cars instead of a place to sit and watch TV, they can undo it. But in general, when you go all out, you take that garage door off, you make it livable space, that's going to decrease the number of people who are interested in the home.
Thanks, Amy. MarketWatch reporter Amy Hoke. So removing a bedroom, removing closets, converting the garage into livable space, and too much wallpaper, all said to possibly decrease your home's value during a renovation. 14 minutes before the hour on This Weekend.
You're a small to mid-sized business with 300 to 3,000 employees. You face the same network security challenges as big businesses do, but can't support a big IT investment, leaving your doors open to advanced cyber threats. Barracuda Next Generation Firewalls provide all the core features of enterprise firewalls and UTMs, but without hidden costs and deployment hurdles, making owning a big business firewall no big deal for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Next Gen Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/firewalls.
Spare yourself the misery of calling your mother-in-law if you need help with preparing your turkey this Thanksgiving. Instead, try the Butterball Turkey Talk Line. They don't snicker and roll their eyes, at least not to your face. We're joined now by Nicole Johnson, co-director of the Talk Line. She's in the call center. Nicole, what are things like there?
You know, we've been in existence now for over 35 years. And one thing that remains the same is tradition, bringing back, you know, a lot of the past memories and recipes and photos, if you will, and trying to bring them to the present. And in fact, that's our theme this year, is Throwback Thanksgiving. So I mentioned the Butterball.com website. I mentioned Facebook. For everybody listening out there, if you want to submit a picture or a recipe, it's a lot of fun ways for us to incorporate the past into the present, and we'd love to see those pictures and recipes.
Give me an example of a throwback recipe.
A throwback recipe. I tell you what, I'm looking at one right now. The traditional green bean casserole, we've thrown in a couple little extra ingredients. There's a couple peppers and stuff in there, and it's just, you know, tweaking the old recipe, if you will, and just making it something a little bit more fresh. But we have a lot of recipes you can visit at the Butterball.com website. And actually, we have a lot of people that call every year, 1-800-BUTTERBALL, 1-800-288-8372. They simply give our staff their name and address, and we'll send them out. We create a new recipe book every year.
Really? Nice.
And they can just give us their name and address, and we'll just send them the recipe book. So that's something fun we do as well.
What do you think is the most common question you get?
It never fails. Year after year, it's how do I go about thawing my turkey? And believe it or not, we get a lot of those phone calls the week of Thanksgiving, the day before Thanksgiving. We even get that phone call the day of Thanksgiving. So we tell people, yeah, there's two acceptable methods in which to thaw your turkey. There's the refrigeration method, which takes 24 hours for every 4 pounds of turkey meat to thaw in your fridge.
Wow.
But for those phone calls that we get the day before Thanksgiving or even on Thanksgiving morning, obviously they don't have that time to thaw in the refrigerator. So we tell them opt for the cold water bath. It takes about a half hour per pound. So a 20-pound turkey is going to take only 10 hours using that method.
Wow. We're speaking with Nicole Johnson. She's co-director of the Butterball Turkey Talk Line. How many folks do you think you'll speak to on Thanksgiving Day in full-scale panic mode?
You know what? It's pretty amazing. On Thanksgiving Day alone, we actually field about 10,000 phone calls.
Jeez.
On Thanksgiving Day alone, which is pretty amazing to consider the fact that we're open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m.
Wow.
Central Standard Time. So needless to say, we are talking a lot of turkey. In fact, we like to keep our staff well-nourished, and they're pretty hoarse after the day is over. So we actually supply them some soup to kind of soothe their throats because we're pretty chatty that day.
How often do your folks turn around and say get blamed for something just from somebody who's mad that something went wrong?
Okay, well, those are really interesting calls, if you will, and we receive them every year. You always know it's going to be an interesting call when you answer the phone call. Butterball Turkey Talk Line, how can I help you?
Right.
And you know it because you're on speaker. And it's usually a wife and a husband. And they're usually sort of the debating, and you're sort of the turkey right. counselor because he thinks to do it one way, she may think to do it another. And so you're sort of, you know, helping them debate. We come to a consensus, and the phone call is over. But those are always some interesting phone calls.
Thanks, Nicole. Nicole Johnson from the Butterball Turkey Talk Line. Did you hear how she dropped that in, by the way she answers the phone? Think she's not an expert, right? 12 years on the job. Good for her. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. Either by chance or choice, NFL teams have gone to their backup quarterbacks frequently this season. How about these numbers from USA Today? 12 quarterbacks who did not begin the season in the lineup have combined to start 28 games this season. That number could grow Sunday. Teams approach the quarterback depth chart in various ways. Some, like the Broncos, favor a seasoned starter like Peyton Manning ahead of a promising developmental talent like Brock Osweiler.
Osweiler on fourth down. Flushed by DeVito, steps away from a tackle, avoids another one, throws one to the end zone, and it is a Denver touchdown.
Dave Logan on the call for KOA Radio in Denver. Clubs with younger franchise quarterbacks like the Indianapolis Colts' Andrew Luck and Carolina Panthers' Cam Newton tend to employ veteran understudies who can mentor the starter. That said, USA Today ranked the teams on their backup quarterback situations. The top five, number one, the Colts. Number two, the Cardinals. Three, the Panthers, followed by the Eagles and the Seahawks. The worst five, the Ravens, the Giants, the Bengals, the Falcons, and lastly, the Chicago Bears. That'll do it for this program. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Mailing your letters and packages has just gotten a lot easier thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can mail and ship anything, anywhere, using just your computer and printer. No more trips to the post office. It's so easy. Anyone can do it. Just click, print, and mail. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage right from your desk. Stamps.com does all the work for you. They even give you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail. The setup, well, that's easy too. Within minutes, you'll be printing your very own postage and you never have to go to the post office again. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, which includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's Stamps.com, then enter Deal.